Hello, and welcome to Ending Family Homelessness Effective Interventions Webinar and Conference Call. My name is Maisha. I will be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Please note this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the webinar over to Megan Mack. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Well, on behalf of First Focus and all of the presenters today, I'd like to thank you for joining us and appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule for a webinar on a very important topic to all of us. As many of you know, people who work across the country and here in D.C., that the headlines are filled with indicators that our economy is improving, but the effects of the Great Recession continue to linger for millions of homeless children and families, with over 1.1 million children identified as homeless in the 2011-2012 school year. In order to end child and family homelessness in the United States, policies need to be developed that address the root causes of family homelessness. So today we are going to talk about the different issues facing families and children who are homeless, as well as address some of the policy proposals and recommendations that we have here at First Focus, and we're very excited also to find out more about what federal agencies are doing in regards to family and child homelessness. So I'm going to introduce our speakers and then we'll get started. First off, we're going to have Lindsay Knott, who is a management and program analyst with the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, where she supports the council's work to end chronic homelessness and homelessness among families and children. And for those of you who aren't familiar with USICH, it's a great initiative that has been brought together by the current administration, that there are representatives from every federal agency across the board. People come together to talk about the issues of homelessness facing many different people in our country, and we've been really appreciative of the administration's work to do that. While at USICH, Lindsay has supported USICH's work to develop the family connection, building systems to end family homelessness, an interactive resource designed to help communities and stakeholders build and implement an effective housing crisis response system for families. And so she'll be talking more about that, as well as we're hoping that many of you can provide feedback for Lindsay. Following, we'll have Maureen Hayes, who is a senior research associate at the National Center on Family Homelessness and the project director for the SHIFT study, a multi-year project sponsored by the Marie C. and Joseph C. Wilson Foundation that examines the effectiveness of different housing models in helping families achieve self-sufficiency and stability. Maureen is also the lead evaluator for the campaign to end child homelessness. And lastly, we'll hear from Kara Baldari, who is the Senior Policy Director for Family Economics and Legal Counsel at First Focus. We, of course, are, many of you are aware of it, but we're a national bipartisan children's advocacy center dedicated to making children and families the priority in the federal policy and budget decisions. In this role, Kara aims to increase federal investments and economic supports that can make a dramatic difference in low-income family budgets and lift children and families out of poverty. So we welcome all of the speakers here today, and we're going to first start with Maureen.
Great. Thanks very much. Hi, everyone. Very happy to be here today and to share some information with you about the SHIFT study, Services and Housing Interventions for Families in Transition. Going to start with just providing a very brief explanation of the study. The SHIFT study looked at families and three different types of housing program models, emergency shelters, transitional housing, and permanent supportive housing. We followed families for 2.5 years after they entered a housing program and conducted interviews with the mothers at three different points, when they first entered the housing program, 15 months later, and then finally at 30 months. There's a lot of information that I have about the SHIFT study, but for our purposes today, I'm going to focus on three different areas. First, a few of the outcomes related to children, and then looking at mother's history of trauma and also mental health issues, and then finally residential stability. So first, in terms of the children, one of the major findings of the SHIFT study was that mother-child separations were very common among these families, not only during the course of the study, but even prior to entering a housing program. 55% of the mothers reported having had a child live apart from them at some point prior to entering their housing program. And then during the course of the study, we found that more than 40% of children lived apart from their mothers during just that first year. And then for the second 15 months, 36% of children lived apart from their mother. The reasons for these separations, it should be noted, was not normally because they were removed by Department of Social Services or Children Protective Services, but actually it was a decision on the family to try and cope with the particular situations they were facing. So, for example, a child would be moved to live with her grandmother because the mother was feeling overwhelmed and they thought it would provide some relief for the mother, or was living with an aunt to try and prevent disruption to the child's schooling, or sometimes a mother will send a child to live with a family or friend to try and protect the child from the experience and the stigma of living in a homeless shelter. We did look at what predicted these separations and found that it was factors that were challenging for families. So, for example, residential instability, it was more common for younger mothers to have a child live apart. If the family had more children, it was more likely to have a child live apart. Mother's unemployment, if she was in mental health treatment, or if she was attending Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous, suggesting that there was a substance abuse issue that was being dealt with. We also interviewed the mother at each time point regarding one specific child to get detailed information about their emotional and behavioral functioning. We call that the target child. We found that more than 40% of the children had peer problems, and this was consistent across the course of the study, did not improve or get worse. We also found that 65% had conduct problems or hyperactivity. Again, that was consistent for the course of the study. And then emotional problems, actually there were shifts in how children were coping and functioning with emotionally. At the baseline, when they first entered the program, 14% of children had emotional problems. By 15 months, after moving into a housing program, this jumped up to nearly 40%. The rates in the different types of housing programs were pretty consistent, regardless if they were emergency shelter, transitional housing, or permanent supportive housing families. And then at 30 months, it decreased a bit, again, down to a little less than a quarter of the children having emotional problems. However, there were big differences when we looked at it according to housing group. And as you can see, transitional housing and permanent supportive housing children went back down to rates that were typical to at the baseline level, 12% and then down to 4%, but remained elevated for children who started out in an emergency shelter at 24%. Important to keep that in mind as we're looking at other findings regarding residential instability and how that may be affecting children's functioning in the long term.
Hi, Maureen. This is Kara. Sorry to interrupt, but we don't see the slides advancing on our end, and if you haven't intended to advance them yet, that's fine. We just wanted to flag that.
I have been advancing them on my end, so I apologize.
Maureen, we are able to advance it on our end, so we are happy to do that if that'd be helpful.
Okay. I apologize. If you could, that would be, I'm sorry, because I'm not able to advance it now. So,
no problem. Just give us a minute. If you want to continue with your audio, we'll attempt to start advancing it on this end.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Okay. So we also looked at some of the experiences and outcomes for the mothers in this study, and I am on slide 5 for when you're advancing the slides. And very important finding from the study were the rates of lifetime trauma events for the mothers. 93% of the mothers had at least one experience of trauma in their lifetime. 87% had multiple traumas. And unfortunately, the most common type of trauma was violent victimization. 70% had been physically assaulted in their lifetime, and nearly half had been sexually abused or sexually assaulted. With these high rates of trauma, it's not surprising then that mental health problems were also common among the mothers. Major depressive symptoms were reported by most of the mothers. It decreased a bit over the course of the study, but was pretty consistent across the 2.5 years. And half of the mothers met the diagnostic criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder at the baseline. Over the course of the study, that dropped to 40%, but still very high rates of post-traumatic stress disorder. We also asked for self-reports of mental health disorders and if they had been diagnosed with different disorders, and very few of these mothers who met the diagnostic criteria actually had been diagnosed or knew that they had PTSD. And, of course, we would be concerned about these mental health issues and the overall well-being of the mothers, but it also has important implications in terms of outcomes and how it impacts other things. Depression predicted educational and emotional problems for children, and PTSD symptom severity predicted major depression, mother's unemployment, and residential instability, as well as some poor child outcomes. Okay, next slide. In looking at residential instability, it's important first to look at the residential mobility that families experience even before they entered the housing program. The vast majority, up to 93% of the families, had moved multiple times prior to entering the housing program. And so it's important because it illustrates that even before entering the housing program, these families and children have endured a lot. When we looked at the rates at each follow-up period, we found that the patterns of residential instability were continuing for many of the families, even though they had entered a housing program. At 15 months, 63% of the families were still residentially unstable, and at 30 months, 50% of the families were residentially unstable. So, of course, then we wanted to try and understand what was causing these high rates of residential instability. And at 15 months, we found that there were three significant predictors: the mother's lower level of education, being unemployed, and low self-efficacy. At 30 months, this changed, and the only significant predictors were the severity of the mother's trauma symptoms and low self-efficacy. I should also note that we've done some additional analyses that looked at housing vouchers or Section 8 vouchers to see how that impacted residential stability. And we found that it not having a voucher was predictive of instability at 15 months, but at 30 months, so for long-term instability, it was not a significant factor. When you consider how trauma symptoms can affect behavior, particularly for somebody living in a housing program. You can see that it may sabotage or undermine their ability to take full advantage of the services and the supports that's been offered. These mothers typically have difficulty following through on things. They have many interpersonal conflicts. They become agitated and angry easily. They may seem emotionally disconnected and then suddenly very reactive. They tend to have, they may have harsh or neglectful parenting practices and often have substance abuse issues as well if they are self-medicating. So all of these types of behaviors could negatively affect their ability to fully utilize the opportunities that the housing program would offer. So in considering these outcomes and how they would impact or inform policy and program practices, the first consideration is the nearly universal presence of trauma experiences among homeless families. And so with that knowledge that the majority, you know, the vast majority of these mothers have trauma experiences, trauma-informed care is a really important consideration for all programs serving homeless or at-risk families. And just to be clear, trauma-informed care is separate and a different practice than trauma-specific services. Trauma-informed care refers to really a cultural change in an organization so that all of the staff in any position are knowledgeable and feel confident in their understanding of trauma and their responses to clients and their work with them is affected accordingly. Trauma-specific services are looking at an individual and they're trying to address any issues with some specific mental health intervention. So we have known previously that effective responses to family homelessness include affordable housing, housing vouchers, stabilizing families as quickly as possible, and also providing case management that will support their development and steps towards economic independence. But now with this information from the SHIFT study, which really looked at families for a much longer period of time than any study's been able to before, we understand now that these trauma histories are not only a characteristic of these mothers and families, but also are directly impacting their ability to establish long-term residential stability. So with this new knowledge to shift our approach in addressing family homelessness, there are a few specific steps that can be taken. Comprehensive assessments of both the mothers and the children, and that include assessments for depression, trauma, and child development. The importance of these findings speaks also to the need to identify those most in need or most at risk. 93% of the mothers had a trauma history, but 93% of the families was not that rate that was unstable. So it's really identifying those not just with the PTSD diagnosis, but those with severe symptoms who may be more at risk for instability in the future so that resources and efforts can be targeted specifically and pointedly. Also, trauma-informed care across organizations and systems to empower both the service providers and the policy makers to develop systems that will help these mothers and families as effectively as possible and also empower the mothers and families that are in the programs. Additionally, parenting supports and skills training that address the impact of maternal depression on parenting and children's development, and also developing and supporting parental competency and strengthening children's resilience. And finally, child-centered services and programs. One thing that we did find is that very few services were provided for children in any of the programs, and those were geared towards the mother's employment or education level. and children were largely missing any supports or services directed towards them specifically. I am now going to pass the baton to
Andy. Thank you very much, Maureen. This is Megan. I'm just going to jump in here real quick. We apologize about any technical difficulties that we're having to for folks. Before we move on to Lindsay, I just want to remind people who are listening through their computer that make sure that you have it on mute. Down in the lower left-hand corner, there's something that looks like a telephone. You can mute yourself there. Your phone line should be on mute through the phone system, but just, you know, in case there's any issues, please try to mute yourself. We have now, I think, fixed our technical difficulty issues. We apologize about that. We believe you all should be seeing the slides for Lindsay. At the same time, if you're not or if you still are having technical issues, please remember that this will be recorded and that we will pass the PowerPoints on to all of you, and we deeply apologize for any technical issues. With that, I'll pass it on to Lindsay.
Thank you, Megan. It's my pleasure to be here with you all today. My name is Lindsay Knotts. I'm an analyst with the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. And today I'll be presenting on our resource, Family Connection, Building Systems to End Family Homelessness. So just for a little bit of context, Opening Doors is the federal strategic plan to prevent and end homelessness, and it was established in 2010. The plan calls for engagement federally and in states and communities across the country with the private sector and at every level of government. It sets four ambitious and achievable goals. I'd like to call special attention to the bolded goal there, the third one, which is to prevent and end homelessness among families, youth, and children. So we know that on one night in January of 2013, service providers and volunteers, just like you, counted almost 71,000 families and their children who were experiencing homelessness. So we really believe that this is just a national tragedy, and I imagine that you do too. That's why you're here joining us today. So no family and no child should ever experience homelessness. Yet we know that based on these data, every single night too many do. In communities throughout the country, providers and advocates are performing everyday heroics in an effort to meet the needs of families experiencing homelessness. And we recognize that when you're faced with this challenge, it can be difficult to focus on anything else. So we want you to know that we're committed to partnering with you to find solutions. And we've tried to break down the key strategies for local action in a digestible way in Family Connection, the resource that I'll cover here today. Your federal partners are committed to working with you to build local systems to end family homelessness, to assess the needs of families and their children, and to prevent it when possible, and to connect families to appropriate housing and services within communities across the country, so that they can quickly exit homelessness. So we know that we can't solve a problem that we can't see. This is why it's important to understand the profile and the needs of families and their children that we're serving. So recognizing that families experience homelessness look very much like low-income families, we know that situations in which these families experience crises that lead to the loss of housing will continue to likely occur. Ending family homelessness does not mean that children and their parents will never experience a housing crisis and be without housing again. However, it does mean that there will be a response, a system response in place that provides shelter to all who need it while supporting rapid movement into permanent housing across communities. So an end to family homelessness means that no family will be without shelter and that homelessness will be a rare and brief occurrence. To achieve this, state and local and federal partners must work together to strengthen our local crisis response system by ensuring that no family is living unsheltered, by providing the necessary resources that allow families to quickly and safely reenter housing, permanent housing, to link families to the benefits, supports, and community-based services they need to achieve and maintain housing stability, and to be sure that we have the capacity to implement effective prevention methods to make sure that families avoid homelessness in the first place. So As you may know, USICH recently released Family Connection, Building Systems to End Family Homelessness. This is a resource that's aimed at expanding an effective partnership with communities to prevent and end homelessness for families. Family Connection is designed to support you, communities, and stakeholders and advocates to build and implement effective housing crisis response systems. You'll find the definition of an end to family homelessness that I just described embedded in that document. Family Connection also includes resources, tools, and detailed information included throughout to support implementation of the policies articulated in the document. While many resources are available now, and we hope that you begin using them if you haven't already, we and our federal agencies and policy experts are developing additional tools that will continue to be added and linked to the Family Connection resource, which is interactive and online, so we encourage you to continue checking back there. So this diagram illustrates how an effective crisis response system should look. It can assess not only the needs of adults in the family, but children as well. Maureen touched on this in her presentation. This flowchart is not intended to depict a linear process. In some communities, coordinated assessment happens at the front door, and others it may look differently. We know that the assessment process takes a variety of shapes and sizes at the local level. It may happen once a family is actually already in shelter. An effective crisis response system is equipped with the ability to prevent or divert homelessness when possible, or to provide temporary shelter and support when needed, with the safety of families always at the center of our work. It can connect families to the appropriate housing, whether it's rapid rehousing, affordable housing, community-based housing, or service-intensive housing like transitional housing or permanent supportive housing. An effective crisis response system also has the capacity to connect families to necessary mainstream resources and services within the community, such as TANF, healthcare services, child welfare, education, child care, employment, training, etc. And finally, an effective system for families does all these things in a culturally competent and trauma-informed way, taking into account the distinct strengths and needs of the adults as well as the children in the family. So here are the key areas of action that we set forth with this plan. So we believe that these are the ways in which to achieve an effective system for families. These were developed through a review of research, engagement with communities, and through an interagency working group process. 13 different federal agencies participated in the development of this document and outlined these four strategy areas for federal action that agencies are taking, as well as complementary state and local action. So the first is to develop a coordinated assessment system with the capacity to assess strengths and needs of families and their children and connect them to targeted prevention assistance when possible and temporary shelter when needed. Every family within a local system should be assessed. The second is to ensure that interventions and assistance are tailored to the needs of families and their children, to provide rapid rehousing assistance to the majority of families experiencing homelessness, to ensure that families have increased access to affordable housing, if at all possible, and to help communities target these resources effectively, and to direct more service-intensive housing interventions to the highest need households in the community. The third is to help communities connect to the mainstream resources, benefits, employment, community-based services that are needed to sustain housing and to achieve housing stability. Improving linkages to the local mainstream systems to help families gain access to these resources more quickly is at the center of this strategy. And finally, the fourth one is to develop and build upon evidence-based practices for serving families experiencing or at risk of experiencing homelessness. So what is coordinated assessment? In order for the strategies that I just discussed to work, people have to be matched with the appropriate resource. And on the flip side, the resources must be available within the community to meet the needs of the people and the families there. Coordinated assessment should be designed to make sure that people's needs are matched with the appropriate intervention and housing and services, but that it also provides the feedback loop at the system level to ensure that the housing resources are actually meeting the needs of all the people who are entering the service system. So we know that coordinated assessment looks different in each community. It might look one way in a rural community and a totally different way in an urban community. I discussed this a little bit already. It's important to look at what the core components of a coordinated assessment system should be and to make sure that communities and regions are utilizing those. So those are what are depicted on the slide here to provide prevention and diversion assistance, including financial assistance, mediation, housing location and support, temporary shelter with stabilization services, and ensuring always the safety of survivors of domestic violence. So for families, coordinated assessment should be done at or near the front door, and it should connect families to emergency shelter and other housing resources. It will take some of the subjectivity out of the assessment and referral process. A family's success in getting into housing and exiting homelessness shouldn't be dependent only on the case manager's connections within the community, though that's certainly an element of what should be happening. There should be a systematic approach in place for moving people through the homeless service response system. Coordinated assessment should also be looking at all the needs of the family members. We discussed this already as well. And from a system perspective, we know that implementation of coordinated assessment doesn't happen overnight. It is going to evolve over time, and it may take a lot of planning. Your system may not reflect what was depicted on the diagram, but it's important to really consider how to right-size the services within your community. So here is the why. Why do we do coordinated assessment? It allows us to move away from a first come, first serve basis into a more systematic approach, takes away the subjectivity, instills a more fair process, and ensures that more families are receiving services because they're being matched to the appropriate services, allowing us to use our resources as efficiently as possible. So the second key strategy, tailored interventions and assistance. So we know that not all families need the same intervention. They should be tailored to the specific needs of the families and children. Not all of those families need intensive services. So transitional housing and permanent supportive housing must be matched and reserved for the most high-need families within the community. We must also note the importance of connecting families to affordable housing within the community and to using rapid rehousing, which could potentially take the place of very expensive interventions at the local level that may not be achieving the right outcomes. This intervention allows us to serve more families. So what is rapid rehousing? A few months ago, the USICH with the National Alliance on Homelessness HUD, the Housing and Urban Development, and the VA developed a resource titled The Core Components of Rapid Rehousing, and those include housing search assistance, some assistance for paying for rent, so the financial component, whether that be short-term or medium-term financial assistance. Rapid rehousing should be tailored to the needs of the family as they're coming into the system, so they might need 1 to 3 months. Some families might need many more months than that of assistance, and provides housing-based case management. That's one of the crucial pieces of a rapid rehousing model. And most importantly, it's connecting families to services within the community. This allows us, again, to serve more families because they're being placed into their own unit. It's unlikely that they'll come back into the service system. So a connection to mainstream resources. This is the third key strategy area. Our partners across the government, or across the federal government, have a strong commitment to ending homelessness among families and children. Many of the mainstream resources are administered by those different agencies. So these resources must be utilized if we're going to end homelessness by 2020. And at the federal level, we're working to improve coordination with and linkages to a range of these resources on a daily basis. So I'd like to highlight, just a few resources. For example, the TANF information memorandum. Last February, this letter was issued to the administrators of local TANF agencies encouraging them to use TANF funds to serve families experiencing homelessness, and we believe that this is a really crucial resource at the local level. In terms of early childhood efforts, the behavioral and developmental screener was released by the Administration for Children and Families at HHS through their Birth to Five initiative. And this screener is really useful, and the goal is that infants and toddlers who are in shelter are screened at intake so that their needs are being met. There are guidance and resources to state Head Start agencies regarding partnerships with homeless service providers. Another key focus is on connecting families to benefits, employment, and employment services. Most families will struggle to achieve housing stability without achieving living wage employment. And we know that we need to engage state and local partners to create better access for people experiencing homelessness. We're trying to do that through these and other resources. So we encourage you to use these resources as conversation starters and these the tools that I've highlighted here at the state and local level. And finally, the last key strategy area is around evidence-based practices. Quite a bit of evidence is currently out there on evidence-based practices for serving families experiencing homelessness as well as their children. These evidence-based practices can lead to improved outcomes for families being served by homeless service providers. So I wanted to highlight just a couple of EBPs. First, trauma-informed care, which Maureen also touched on. The National Center with me today have a great resource called the Trauma-Informed Organizational Toolkit for homeless service providers. We encourage you to access that resource. SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration at HHS, and the Administration for Children and Families are doing some important work in this space as well. Prenatal and infant care, home visiting is showing some great promise in serving mothers with their children, so these partnerships are really crucial at the local level. Head Start Trauma Smart, there's a great program out of Kansas City working to address early childhood trauma within the context of Head Start programs. I'd encourage you to look that up as well. And finally, parents as teachers, this is another practice that touches on school-aged kids and teens. So we know that research continues to evolve and improve. We'll be able to utilize resources more efficiently as we gain more knowledge about what's working. At the federal level, we're committed to continuing our research efforts to identify the practices that are effective in serving these families, particularly around what works best and for whom. So in terms of resources to improve your crisis response system, I just wanted to connect you to a couple. There's a link to Family Connection. I've been talking about it, so I wanted to make sure that you knew where to find it. As I said before, we're continuing to develop this resource, and USICH, along with federal partners, will actually be holding a couple of more webinars in a series on that, so we encourage you to participate in those if you're able. Core Components of Rapid Rehousing, I reviewed that document as well. There's a link to the Birth to Five Shelter Screener, the TANF-IM, and a Housing First Checklist. And with that, I'm going to pass it over to Kara Baldari with First Focus.
Great. Thanks, Lindsay. I'm just going to switch here to my presentation. All right, well, I'm going to get started as I do that. There seems to be a little bit of a delay, but hopefully we'll get the slides up and running soon. As Megan mentioned, and Lindsay, I'm Kara Baldari, and I lead our family economics portfolio at First Focus Campaign for Children. And we work on a wide range of issues affecting children. We're a national children's advocacy group, and we're dedicated to making children and families a priority in federal budget and policy decisions. We focus on the most vulnerable children in our society. So despite reports that the economy is improving, we know that the recession is still having a significant effect for many in our society, especially children and families. Child poverty in the U.S. is at a 20-year high, with almost 22% of children living below the poverty line. The child poverty rate continues to remain higher than the poverty rate for other groups in our society. Although children continue to bear the brunt of the recession, there are programs such as the Earned Income Tax Credit and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, that lift millions of children out of poverty each year. However, no program has had a larger effect at reducing poverty in America than Social Security and Medicare, which has reduced the senior poverty rate to 9% by 2012. There has been no similar investment for children and families that have had such a significant impact at reducing poverty. And as Megan mentioned, this includes a record number of homeless children and families. In the 2011 to 2012 school year, over 1.1 million students were identified as homeless by the Department of Education. And as you can see, we got these slides up and running, so sorry for that delay. As Megan mentioned, we will be circulating them at the end, so if you missed any, we will make sure to get those out to everyone. So the number of homeless children and families has seen a 10% increase since the previous school year and a 72% increase since the start of the recession. While some of these students are living with families in emergency or transitional shelters, many of these homeless families are living in motels or doubled-up situations where they are sharing the housing of other people due to economic reasons. Although the focus of this webinar is homeless families, I wanted to flag that some of these homeless students are not living with their families and may be living unaccompanied from any adults, and that's for various reasons. Luckily, there's a lot of great work being done to also address the specific needs of these youth, and First Focus, along with others, is really supportive of those efforts. I wanted to also note that many of the homeless students identified by the Department of Education are often not counted by HUD in their annual point-in-time count due to the point-in-time counts methodology of counting families or unaccompanied youth living in shelters or on the street at the time of the count, while the Department of Education also reports those students who are living with their families or on their own in doubled-up situations or in motels, as well as shelters or on the street. It is no surprise to hear that homelessness is extremely stressful for children and families, and Maureen alluded to a lot of this. They're experiencing very transient living situations that are often chaotic, unstable, and overcrowded. There has been findings that illustrate the negative effect on the physical, psychological, and emotional health of homelessness for children and families, one being obviously the study that Maureen mentioned. It can also take a severe toll on a child or youth's educational performance. Homeless students may be forced to often switch schools, and research has shown that children and youth who experience numerous moves are also less likely to graduate from high school than children who move less frequently. They may face other barriers, such as a lack of transportation to school, lack of school supplies, or lack of proof of residency to enroll in school. They often have no stable or quiet place to sleep or study, which makes it difficult to complete homework and focus in class. Luckily, the McKinney-Vento Education for Homeless Children and Youth program provides many protections and resources for homeless students, but as I will discuss later in my policy recommendations, this program is severely underfunded. We've already discussed that maternal trauma and depression is one strong indicator for homelessness and residential instability. We have also seen a variety of economic factors that have contributed to the continuing large amount of homeless families, which includes the rise in housing foreclosures. In 2012, First Focus released a report with the Brookings Institution that found that more than 8 million children are directly affected by the ongoing foreclosure crisis. This includes families that lost or are at risk of losing owner-occupied homes as well as rented homes to foreclosure. In addition to putting families at risk of homelessness, studies show that children who live in areas with high rates of foreclosure experience decreased health and well-being due to children having to move, or the effect of the parents' financial stress on children. Studies have also found that zip codes with high foreclosure rates also have high rates of non-elective visits to emergency rooms and hospitals. In addition, many low-income families are renters and find themselves homeless when their rental property goes into foreclosure. Currently, about 43 million households are renters, and 40% of households at risk of eviction due to foreclosure are renters. Another large issue is the lack of affordable housing. Approximately 46% of households with children, both homeowners and renters, report that they struggle to afford housing or that their housing is physically inadequate or overcrowded. HUD defines housing as affordable when any rent or mortgage payments comprise 30% or less of monthly household income. For every 100 extremely low-income renter households, there are just 31 affordable and available units. and 11.3 million renter households pay more than half their incomes on housing. There was a recent study through Johns Hopkins that found a link between how much a family spends on housing and a child's cognitive ability. When a family spent more than half its income on housing, a child's reading and math scores tended to suffer. When a family spends a large percentage of their income on housing, they often don't have the funds for other resources to help with a child's development. These outcomes were also the case, also occurred when a family spent less than 20% of income on housing, for it often meant that the housing was in a distressed neighborhood or in poor condition, which can also take a toll on a child. So finally, what we can do about it. So first focus is working with our partner, our 501c4 First Focus Campaign for Children, to try to really improve outcomes for these homeless families. As I alluded to earlier, the U.S. Department of Education and HUD have different definitions of homelessness when it comes to children and families to determine eligibility for their services. This makes it difficult for some homeless children and youth, such as those living doubled up or in motels, to access HUD services such as transitional housing and other wraparound supports that may be critical to transitioning to residential stability. We understand that resources are limited, and it is often impossible to serve everyone. However, we feel local service providers should be the ones making determinations regarding the homeless families and individuals in their communities who are most in need of services. Congress and the administration should take measures to align HUD's definition of homeless children with the definition used by the U.S. Department of Education so that all homeless children and youth can access the critical services, such as transitional housing, they need to achieve residential stability. Previous legislation has been introduced to amend HUD's definition of homelessness by including children and youth in their definition who have been verified as homeless by personnel in any of the following federal programs: Head Start programs, Runaway and Homeless Youth Act programs, and early intervention programs under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, Part C. We are currently working hard with some other partners to get this legislation reintroduced in the new Congress. One large barrier that we see to addressing child and family homelessness is the lack of awareness on Capitol Hill. Therefore, we need to urge our members of Congress to visit a homeless shelter in their district so they can see firsthand the struggle of homeless children and families in their community. Representative Jackie Speier from California has been leading an effort to encourage members to take such a challenge, and several members have already taken her up on it. First Focus has been encouraging additional members of Congress to visit a homeless shelter in their district through op-eds and other social media avenues. In order to address the lack of affordable housing, one ongoing effort to increase the amount of adequate affordable rental housing is the National Housing Trust Fund, which was established by Congress in 2008 but is yet to be funded. Capitalizing the fund would address the current severe shortage of affordable rental homes by creating new affordable housing units as well as preserving existing rental units and making additional units available. There are several efforts in the works to fund the National Housing Trust Fund, and I would encourage everyone to visit the website of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, which is a great partner of ours and is really leading the way to fund the National Housing Trust Fund. In order to prevent homelessness among renter households who are evicted because their landlord enters foreclosure, we need to encourage Congress to pass the Permanently Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure Act, which in the House is H.R. 3543, and in the Senate it is 1761. And in the House it has been introduced by Representative Keith Ellison from Minnesota, and in the Senate Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut. The original Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure Act was passed in 2009 and requires that bona fide tenants living in foreclosed properties get at least 90 days' notice before requiring them to vacate this property, and it allows tenants with leases to occupy the property until the end of their lease term. This provides tenants with the basic right of some housing stability. However, PTFA will expire at the end of 2014 unless Congress acts to extend it. If passed, this legislation would make the Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure Act, or PTFA, permanent and would add a private right of action to help ensure that the law is enforceable by tenants. Finally, we need to preserve current federal investments for children and families in the FY15 appropriations process. While many of these programs saw some of their funds restored in 2014 from post-sequester levels, spending levels for most of these programs are not where they were pre-sequester. As many of you know, the FY15 appropriations process is currently underway in Congress, and spending levels for the next year for homeless assistance programs, affordable housing programs, and human services programs are currently being debated. This includes funding for the McKinney-Vento Education for Homeless Children and Youth Program, which I mentioned earlier. We are advocating for funding to be restored to the 2011 level of $75 million, and it's currently funded around $65 million. This will provide public school districts with additional resources to identify homeless children living in their district, enroll them in the school that is best for the child, and ensure that the child has the proper resources to succeed in school. I will briefly wrap up by saying that there, in the past few years, we have seen a lot of great momentum to address this problem of family homelessness. And efforts such as the one we heard today, from Maureen and Lindsay, are taking really important steps to help us both understand the needs of homeless families and the steps we need to take to address them. However, we obviously have a lot more work to do, and so we hope this information has been helpful to inform your efforts, and we would, love to work, with many different partners on this issue. So please don't hesitate to contact me with any questions. My contact information is listed there. I want to thank Maureen and Lindsay again for their presentations, and I'm going to turn it over to our operator for Q&A.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or hash key. If you are using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up your handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question or a comment, that is star then one on your touch-tone phone. We are now awaiting any questions. Our first question is from Aaron from Washington. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for the great presentation. I'm wondering, you mentioned mainstream resources as an important intervention and important thing to link families to, and you mentioned the fiscal year 15 appropriations process, and I'm wondering if you have thoughts or recommendations on improving the mainstream housing resources, like the Housing Choice Voucher Program or public housing, to better serve homeless families?
Lindsay, I don't know if you have any comments on that before I jump in.
Why don't you go ahead, and I'll pick up after you.
Well, I'll just say that, we know these are really important resources for families, but we also know that there's nearly not enough vouchers and spots for all those families that need it. So, we would not only encourage the increase in availability of these in communities, but also to really prioritize families, for these vouchers. Again, we know there's a lot of need, and we are not trying to pit any kind of, any populations against each other. But we know that often homeless families are invisible in their communities, through living doubled up in other situations. And so we really want to make sure that that the need for these homeless families is known and that they are prioritized when getting these resources.
Yep, this is Lindsay. I think that's exactly right. And I think, so this is where, when I touched on the fact that rapid rehousing is an effective intervention, when affordable housing within the community, like the housing choice vouchers and the public housing, is potentially not available. So it's certainly, I think, affordable housing and the mainstream housing is always the best option for families, and in the cases where and in many communities, we know that that might not be available for all the families experiencing or at risk of experiencing homelessness. I think that's where some of the other interventions, housing interventions, might be useful.
Thank you.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, for any questions or comments, it is still star one on your touch-tone phone. We have no further questions at this time. Are there any closing remarks?
This is Kara from First Focus. I just want to thank everyone again for attending. Again, it will be recorded, and we will be circulating with slides and audio recording for anyone who had any difficulties. And please don't hesitate to follow up with any of the speakers with further questions. So thank you again for your time.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's Ending Family Homelessness and Effective Interventions webinar and conference call. Thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect.